song about a bunch of guys and women who are inspired by the Bible. In the 1640s, they were inspired by the Bible to chop off the head of the King of England. In 1649, St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlord, they defied the law. They were the dispossessed, we're claiming what was theirs. Come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the waste ground grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it shall be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command. They made the laws to train us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed and fields, the rich while poor folks starve. We work, we eat together, we need no sword. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the Lord. Still we are free, though we are poor. Diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. Yeah. From the men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and traversed to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages and destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down. Amanda Palmer, ladies and gentlemen. The world turned upside down. Leon Russellson wrote that. We had a great time here at the Pace Party. Hope you have. Listen, did anybody film that? Because it was great.
I got one for you. How much time do we have?
And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's 7, September 18th. This is the voice of the Republic and the Resistance, standing in the long tradition of freedom fighters for many centuries. That story of the diggers in England is a direct inspiration, of course, because they chopped off the head of Charles I. And if people have the same idea about Charles III, who's now sitting precariously on that golden idol, you've got to keep in mind that there's really nothing on Charles' shoulders to chop off. There's nothing in that head, really. Instead, we're going to cut off the head of the beast itself, not the token symbols of the system, but the actual beast, the corporatocracy. In fact, that beast has three heads, and we're going to examine that today in this educational broadcast. It's really a teach-in, carrying on from the teachings within our Republic Alliance. Now, that's a movement, as you know, if you've listened to the show, and if you follow our work at murderbydecree.com and republicofkanata.org, you'll see that the Republic Alliance grew up over the summer. It now has participants in Canada, America, Ireland, England, France, Spain, Italy, Holland, Denmark, Australia, and the Chilcotin and Anishinaabeg Indigenous Nations in Canada. All of these countries have groups now, they've declared their independence, they've set up common law republics, and they're working to take on the three-headed beast known as the corporatocracy. Well, what are those three heads, you might be asking? Church, state, and corporatocracy. Big money, government, and church. The three-headed beast that really has been responsible for genocide over the centuries. If you read murderbydecree.com, you'll see the hard evidence of how that three-headed octopus is operated in Canada and around the world. And the corporatocracy today is really a merger of all three. This is a new beast in the world. And it's a hard thing to understand because our minds have been swimming in the old system for so long that we find it difficult to detach and look at something for what it is. That's why we have these teach-ins and these educationals, not abstract knowledge, but drawn from our lived experience. This teach-in is really a dialogue between you and me and everybody, comparing what I say with your lived experience in order to arm ourselves for further action, to disestablish the system and raise up our new common law republics. The corporatocracy operates against the three basic axioms of nature, which you heard in that song today, that the world is given in common for all people to share. Nobody has the right by nature to more of it than anybody else. No one has any authority over anyone else. And we're to live in harmony and peace and take care of the creation. Those three axioms of the natural law imbue common law and the vision of all of our republics. Now, the knowledge for action is part of a continuation. Really, this show today is part two of a series I did started yesterday in our Zoom call. We do these Republic Alliance calls between all the different nations every Saturday. And if you'd like to take part in that or help form a republic in one of those countries or in countries that weren't mentioned, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com. Yesterday, we did kind of a background part one on where the common law movement came from, specifically 1998 in Vancouver, Canada, where the first tribunal looking into the Indian residential school death camps occurred. And out of that, there was an attempt, of course, to sue the Crown and the churches for their genocide. And it was blocked on three different occasions by the so-called Crown courts, saying, no, we can't sue the Crown because they're our boss. We then had to go internationally, but guess what? There was no court anywhere in the world that would take on institutions responsible for genocide. You could only accuse individuals of acts of genocide. And so we needed to create a new legal system. That's where the International Common Law Court of Justice came about. That's how it forced Pope Benedict and three cardinals out of office and really led to the deposing of Queen Elizabeth. The fact that she and Benedict have been hiding out for a long time. Well, she's dead now, of course. Her corpse is going all over England. And the fact is that it's the individuals who are the figurehead in the system. When you strike at the head, it has an amazing impact, and we've proven that in practice. Today, we're going to look into the nature of the corporatocracy and a little synopsis on that. First of all, it's taken from everything you hear today is taken not only from our experiences over 25 or more years, but from a book I wrote last year called Memoirs of a Revolutionary, Understanding the Present Tyranny. And it looks at the political economic situation in the globe for the last 50 years since the 1970s. How did the corporatocracy come about? We're going to go into that in some detail today. And take notes. Write to me, angelfire101 at protonmail.com. This show is going to be part of a whole archive of educational resources that you can use with others. We also do it this way so it can be translated into the five different languages in our Republic Alliance as well. So beginning, first of all, a little synopsis of what we're going to talk about. First of all, what is the corporatocracy? Where did it come from? Secondly, what are its features? For example, people often describe it as a total domination society. You know, what are the things that make it operate, if you like, and where did it come from historically? Thirdly, how can we understand it if our minds are still trapped in the old system? So part of my book is a section where I talk about recovering philosophical realism. And in other words, a short explanation of that, a realist doesn't believe that reality is created by thought, that if you will something into being, it'll happen. A realist says, no, reality exists independently of human beings and their thoughts. We could all die tomorrow and reality would continue. It gets away from that kind of egocentric notion that we create our own reality. And philosophical realism is essential if you want to understand the world around you and not simply your particular bias or projection that we all do. We all project our light and shadow onto the world. Doesn't mean that's the way the world is. It means that's the way we are. So understanding philosophical idealism versus realism is very important. How we think and understand something. Fourth point, and very important, what is this thing at a higher kind of macro level? it isn't just a corporate system that's now engulfing the planet. It's also a group mind, and a group spirit. Sometimes it's called a hegemonicon, and a group mind is another way to put it, collective unconscious. We're going to look into all those aspects today to understand this three-headed beast and what it is and how to kill it. That's our task. Before I get into that, I just want to do a little plug for one of our Republic groups in Vancouver, Canada. Went out to the University of British Columbia campus and handed out a flyer, which I just get a kick out of doing this because, of course, I grew up on the University of BC campus in Vancouver. I got my political science, anthropology, and theology degrees there. The UBC is a very interesting place in terms of the side for four reasons. First of all, the records that you find in murderbydecree.com, the documenting the hard proof of mass murder in Indian residential schools. I unearthed that in Kerner Library at the University of British Columbia in the late 1990s before my PhD degree got scuttled there after I got booted out of the United Church. The hard records are there, right in the library. And the other thing about UBC is that it's a center of a lot of investments from corporations that continue to profit off the mass murder of Native people, like in British Columbia, BC Hydro, and a lot of the logging companies like Weyerhaeuser, PetroChina, that's forcing Native people off the land. They're all heavily invested in the UBC campus, as are the churches that are responsible for the genocide, the Catholics, the Anglicans, the United Church. Final point, there's actual mass graves on the southern areas of the University of BC campus and on the Musqueam Reservation. Now, just to paraphrase one of these flyers that are handed out today and went all over the campus, including all over the internet systems on campus. We quote a friend of mine, actually, Les Gurin, who was a maintenance man at the Musqueam Indian Reserve. And Les told me a number of years ago, almost 15 years ago now, how he saw a fellow unloading bags one night on the Musqueam Reservation. Well, it turned out to be Dave Picton, brother of the serial killer, Willie Picton, who's doing time as the fall guy, as the Lee Harvey Oswald, for all the Native women who went missing. Well, Les Gurin took the bags that Dave Picton had buried, and he took them to the Simon Fraser University of Forensics, and sure enough, it turned out to be the bones of young women mixed up with pig remains, exactly the what you find in a serial killing body dumping site. Dave Picton was even hired by the Musqueam Band. Well, Les Gurin went to the police and the press. His life was threatened. They told him to be quiet about it. He talked about the Musqueam chiefs like Wendy Sparrow and Ed John and others who bring in children and guns and drugs through the Celtic shipyards just off the Musqueam Reserve, the upper arm of the Fraser River, right next to wonderful UBC campus. And there's body dumping sites all over the campus, according to Les Gurin. Now, of course, the campus is under provincial jurisdiction, not the city of Vancouver. So the Mounties have total jurisdiction there. Well, Human Rights Watch in New York in 2017 said the RCMP in Canada are directly implicated in the disappearance and murder of Indigenous women. And many hundreds of Native women are routinely abducted and made to disappear by the RCMP. Well, what better place to dump them than a place where the RCMP have total jurisdiction, like the UBC campus and the Musqueam Reserve? But the point is, of course, it's China now who are behind a lot of these disappearances. So these are the flyers now circulating. If you want to copy this, if you live in Vancouver, please write to us. We'll send you PDFs of this leaflet. Go and shower the UBC campus out on Point Grey, but also the UBC campus downtown in Robson Square. Get it into the hands of students, because the leaflet says when you pay tuition, you're funding crimes against humanity. You're committing a crime. Don't pay your tuition, folks. So that's one example of what we're doing on the ground to apply this knowledge and the knowledge we're going to talk about today. So to get onto the main act here, we're going to start with the nature of the corporatocracy. What is it? What do we call it, a corporatocracy, in the first place? Well, the idea, it's interesting. When you go back, it's a Roman idea, of course. All roads lead to Rome and the Vatican. And the first corporation in human history was the Church of Rome. It wasn't called the Vatican until Mussolini gave it that name when it reestablished the Church of Rome in 1929, when his fascist government filled in something that had happened 50 years before, where Garibaldi had deposed the Vatican. Mussolini reestablished the Vatican and gave it that name, created the Vatican Bank, gave it authority as a so-called government, which it is not. But the earlier Church of Rome was the first legal corporation in their year 317. Now, what a corporation does is it removes from accountability the corporate officers. It's a perfect machine for criminality and theft and murder. Because if you're a corporate officer, you have limited liability. You can go and kill someone and then hide behind the corporate shell and you're never touched. Sure enough, that goes on all the time in the Church of Rome, as we know. Priests get away with it all the time because they're part of that corporate structure. Well, what happened in the 1920s and 30s was interesting in Europe, because the Nazi dictatorship and the fascist dictatorship in Italy were both created out of that corporate model. One of the Pope Pius XII, when he was the first power to recognize Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime, he said, fascism is the Catholic social teachings applied in government. So in other words, the model of the Church of Rome and the fascist dictatorship and the Chinese government is all the same. It's this top-down hierarchical notion. There is one figure, the emperor figure, has absolute authority, total domination over everyone in society, and they all are obedient. They must be or they die. It's a slave society, like in Rome. But what's happened today is it's merged. The state, the churches, and big money have merged. And that started really after World War II. We all know about the growth of monopoly capitalism, these huge mega corporations. In fact, by the year 1980, over half of the world economies were not governments or countries, they were corporations. Today, that's even more the case. It's about 90% of all the wealth in the economies is in corporate hands, not the hands of the people or governments. And this was the result of a few things. The bipolar Cold War between the Soviet Union and America that was revived in the 1980s under Reagan and Thatcher, it actually collapsed both societies. Not only the Soviet Union collapsed, but America collapsed. The collapse was less obvious because it continued under the mask of its old so-called democratic, window dressing. But the truth is that permanent domination society, the secret government state, all of that began in the 80s and it's achieved complete fruition today. Now, don't forget, we're not talking political parties. The Democrats, the Republicans, they're shells. Behind it is the same corporate money interests. And in fact, we know for a fact that China is heavily subsidizing both Democrats and Republicans to tear each other apart, to create a civil war in America so that China can continue to buy up the country and pick up the pieces. That's just basic Sun Tzu, the art of war. But what's interesting is the global system that created that has been in the works for over 50 years, and that's the nature of this book I wrote, Memoirs of a Revolutionary, which, by the way, you can get through murderbydecree.com or Amazon. This was predicted over 50 years ago because of a little nutshell description. The history of capitalism for over 200 years, the way it works is you probably know it has booms and busts, big economic expansion, and then sudden inflation and recession and then depression. A boom and a bust, like someone inhaling and exhaling. Well, the reason that happened is there's all this wealth left over, overproduction, that things couldn't be bought. And so what do you do with that excess capital? In the 19th century, they had empires. They exported the capital overseas. They had colonies. During the 20th century, they were colliding so much, the emperors, they had to find a different way to use up the excess capital. So they had wars. Huge wars, World War I, World War II, and then after World War II, the permanent arms economy. The permanent war economy that Hitler had pioneered and all of the other governments picked up, that created a massive arms spending to soak up that excess capital. But here's the thing, as the system got more centralized and the money got more centralized, they couldn't do that anymore because the system became more unstable. You know, in nature, when something gets centralized and unitary, it's more prone to disaster. When you lose flexibility and diversity in a system, like the world economy has done, then it becomes prone to collapse. So, for example, all of the banks of the world are now integrated. And if one collapses, all the others start to collapse. So what's the only way to get around that for capitalism? It isn't to get rid of itself. It's to get more hierarchical, more dictatorial. And the creation of the omni-corporation that controls every aspect of society, not only politics, the politicians are jumping at the whim of the big pharma corporations, of course. We see that all over the world. But the thinking of human beings, you know, in the 1980s, they brought in this whole privatization era to take public assets and sell them off and just hand it over to big banks and corporations to get people brainwashed to think that what was good for a corporation is good for you. And so now all of the government systems are pretty much run by private corporations, like Children's Aid Society that grabs children and traffics them for money. So, I mean, that's the thing to realize. We've had a complete shift in thinking and everything towards this single corporate identity, really fascist totalitarianism. And it's ironic that everyone thinks Germany and Italy were defeated in World War II. In fact, they dominate, they triumphed because of the triumph of their fascist system, which is now the corporatocracy. So you can see a lot of the details that I've left out in that book. We're going to have kind of a detail of that in condensations of this talk that we'll publish online. And the thing to realize, though, is that it's created, some people call it a bureaucratic collectivist society. That is, it's got, at every level, everything is integrated vertically. There's no more horizontal connections between people. You have to break up families. You've got to break up anything that gives people power on the ground. Everything is oriented to the state, the super state, which is really the corporate state. That's the general thing to keep in mind about this. Now, how do you get this to happen? You basically get it to happen through an enormous brainwashing technique. And what's the most effective institution to brainwash people? Religion. And there's actually, we're going to do a break halfway through to hear George Carlin's wise remarks on religion. But don't forget, this is not about spirituality and that inner life and creation. This is about religion, which, by the way, means religio in Latin, means to rebind, to bind people together into one authority. That's not creation. That's not the natural law. That's empire. Religion is an arm of empire. So the most effective means to bring about the corporatocracy has been the power of the Church of Rome, because it's not only the chief financial backer of the corporatocracy and China, which is spearheading the corporatocracy, but it has huge ideological and mind control sway over 1.5 billion and more people on the planet. I mean, even atheists go around saying, well, are you sure you should protest the churches? Don't they have something to do with God? You know, that whole illusion. So, you know, we all know God doesn't need religion or churches or anything, or let alone popes. But that's the thing to understand, that the church has always played that direct role in this, all the more so now. And that's why when we talk about the corporatocracy, we're really talking specifically about China and the Vatican. And we know that that's the deal they signed in Prince Rupert on July 23rd, that gave $780 billion to China for their economic expansion over the next year alone. And why Bergoglio in Rome is now calling back all the money into the Vatican Bank to guarantee that credit and that money to China. So you can see this integration at work. And it all requires that everybody believes the one authority figure. You don't have a mind of your own. You have to believe the authority figure, somebody who even calls himself the bridge between heaven and earth, which is the Pope's official title, Pontifex Maximus, which, by the way, was the official title of the Emperor of Rome. So, you know, you just switch the label, but the same idea is there. You have to obey. So this is something that is really important to keep in mind, because we're seeing the effect of this played out on the ground all the time. And the problem now, and I'm going to rest my voice in a minute and let George Carlin speak to you, but what we see by all this is that there's ultimately, at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, how much are we capable of being aware of this? Our minds are locked in the past, by and large, because we still think we're living under the old system, where there's governments that are accountable. In a total domination society like ours, people are functional slaves. They don't have the minds of their own. There is no democracy. We've seen that. Protests, truckers' convoys, all of that has absolutely no effect because this is what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a faceless, totally unaccountable dead machine. The hand puppets of politicians and all those other people, they have no authority or power whatsoever, and they're the first to admit it. When you protest against a dead thing, there is no response. All it exists for is itself, its own survival and its own efficiency. And it's interesting, there's a quote in the Psalms in the Bible that says, if you worship idols, you become what you worship, a dead idol. And that's, in fact, the template for everyone now. To become as dead as this corporate thing you face. So ultimately, we are invisible to that corporation until we start withdrawing from it. We can protest all we like. We can do all that. It doesn't care. When you withdraw from it and take away your energy from it, you're threatening it because it's a parasite on us. And that's what it can't allow. And that's when you get into the fact that our minds are not our own. It doesn't matter how aware people think they are individually, as long as you're acting like an individual, you're still operating under that group mind. We need another group mind. In the 60s, they called it a counterculture. But we need our own group mind to pull people out of the old group mind. You can't do it as an individual. People try it. And I get this all the time in all the groups I've worked in the common laws, republic assemblies and that. People get to a point, they'll say, yeah, let's pass our laws. Let's do all this. And then we say, yeah, but now we have to enforce it. Bingo, that's where 90% of people drop out. And I mean literally drop out. You never see them again. They run for cover because the thing still owns its minds and it yanks them back. It's like watching an invisible leash yank everybody back mentally. Now, if you're plugged into the internet and they're using its technology, that's even more so because the mind control nature of iPads and the internet are even more extreme. We know that television creates an alpha wave mental energy state in people. iPads and internet do that even more. So if you use that system, your mind is not your own. You're receiving subliminal messages all the time. I often wonder, hey, how come an entire group of people were supporting us one minute, and then literally the next day, they're all attacking us and me personally? Well, that's because their minds have been flicked and reprogrammed because of the technology they're plugged in. We have to turn the technology off if we're to regain our minds. Now, I know that all sounds like a big order, especially if you're emotionally and mentally wedded to that technology, which, of course, we all are to varying degrees, or you wouldn't be listening to this. But the real power begins when you shut it all off, you go outside, you hang around nature and animals and children, and you recover your own mind. We all have to begin there, or all of this is just babble. It doesn't mean anything. It'll just be more words that nobody does anything about. I find the people who take the most action don't go on the internet much. They don't watch television. They're not tied into the technology. They still own more of their own minds. So on that note, we're going to listen to George Carlin talking about religion because George right now is going to be talking about a realist versus an idealistic point of view. He's enunciating what we're going to talk about in the second half of the show, which is we must look at reality the way it is and not the way we want it to be. Here's George Carlin. We'll be back in 9 minutes.
But in the bullshit department, a businessman can't hold a candle to a clergyman. Because I got to tell you the truth, folks. When it comes to bullshit, big time, major league bullshit, you have to stand in awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims, religion. No contest. Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you. He loves you. He loves you and he needs money. He always needs money. He's all powerful, all perfect, all knowing, and all wise. Somehow, just can't handle money. Religion takes in billions of dollars, they pay no taxes, and they always need a little more. Now, you talk about a good bullshit story. Holy shit. Thank you very much. But I want you to know something. This is sincere. I want you to know, when it comes to believing in God, I really tried. I really, really tried. I tried to believe that there is a God who created each of us in his own image and likeness, loves us very much, and keeps a close eye on things. I really tried to believe that, but I got to tell you, the longer you live, the more you look around, the more you realize something is fucked up. Something is wrong here. War, disease, death, destruction, hunger, filth, poverty, torture, crime, corruption, and the ice capades. Something is definitely wrong. This is not good work. If this is the best God can do, I am not impressed. Results like these do not belong on the resume of a supreme being. This is the kind of shit you'd expect from an office temp with a bad attitude. And just between you and me, in any decently run universe, this guy would have been out on his all-powerful ass a long time ago. And by the way, I say this guy because I firmly believe, looking at these results, that if there is a God, it has to be a man. No woman could or would ever fuck things up like this. If there is a God, if there is, I think most reasonable people might agree that he's at least incompetent and maybe, just maybe, doesn't give a shit. Doesn't give a shit, which I admire in a person and which would explain a lot of these bad results. So rather than be just another mindless religious robot, mindlessly and aimlessly and blindly believing that all of this is in the hands of some spooky, incompetent father figure who doesn't give a shit, I decided to look around for something else to worship, something I could really count on. And immediately, I thought of the sun. Happened like that. Overnight, I became a sun worshiper. Well, not overnight. You can't see the sun at night. But first thing the next morning, I became a sun worshiper. Several reasons. First of all, I can see the sun.
Okay.
Yeah. Unlike some other gods I could mention, I can actually see the sun. I'm big on that. If I can see something, I don't know, kind of helps the credibility along, you know? So every day I can see the sun as it gives me everything I need. Heat, light, food, flowers in the park, reflections on the lake, an occasional skin cancer, but hey, at least there are no crucifixions and we're not setting people on fire simply because they don't agree with us. Sun worship is fairly simple. There's no mystery, no miracles, no pageantry, no one asks for money, there are no songs to learn, and we don't have a special building where we all gather once a week to compare clothing. And the best thing about the sun, it never tells me I'm unworthy. Doesn't tell me I'm a bad person who needs to be saved, hadn't said an unkind word, treats me fine. So I worship the sun, but I don't pray to the sun. Know why? I wouldn't presume on our friendship. It's not polite. I've often thought people treat God rather rudely, don't you? Asking trillions and trillions of prayers every day, asking and pleading and begging for favors, do this, give me that, I need a new car, I want a better job. And most of this praying takes place on Sunday, his day off. It's not nice, and it's no way to treat a friend. But people do pray, and they pray for a lot of different things. You know, your sister needs an operation on her crotch. Your brother was arrested for defecating in a mall. But most of all, you'd really like to fuck that hot little redhead down at the convenience store. You know, the one with the eye patch and the club foot. Huh? Can you pray for that? I think you'd have to. And I say, fine, pray for anything you want. Pray for anything. But what about the divine plan? Remember that? The divine plan. Long time ago, God made a divine plan. Gave it a lot of thought, decided it was a good plan, put it into practice. And for billions and billions of years, the divine plan has been doing just fine. Now you come along and pray for something. Well, suppose the thing you want isn't in God's divine plan. What do you want him to do? Change his plan? Just for you? Doesn't it seem a little arrogant? It's a divine plan. What's the use of being God if every rundown schmuck with a $2 prayer book can come along and fuck up your plan? And here's something else, another problem you might have. Suppose your prayers aren't answered. What do you say? Well, it's God's will. Thy will be done. Fine, but if it's God's will and he's going to do what he wants to anyway, why the fuck bother praying in the first place? Seems like a big waste of time to me. Couldn't you just skip the praying part and go right to his will? It's all very confusing. So to get around a lot of this, I decided to worship the sun. But as I said, I don't pray to the sun. You know who I pray to? Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci. Two reasons. First of all, I think he's a good actor, okay? To me, that counts. Second, he looks like a guy who can get things done. Joe Pesci doesn't fuck around. Doesn't fuck around. In fact, Joe Pesci came through on a couple of things that God was having trouble with. For years, I asked God to do something about my noisy neighbor with the barking dog. Joe Pesci straightened that cocksucker out with one visit. It's amazing what you can accomplish with a simple baseball bat. So I've been praying to Joe for about a year now. And I noticed something. I noticed that all the prayers I used to offer to God and all the prayers I now offer to Joe Pesci are being answered at about the same 50% rate. Half the time I get what I want, half the time I don't. Same as God, 50-50. Same as the four-leaf clover and the horseshoe, the wishing well and the rabbit's foot. Same as the mojo man. Same as the voodoo lady who tells you your fortune by squeezing the goat's testicles. It's all the same, 50-50. So just pick your superstition, sit back, make a wish, and enjoy yourself.
And we're back. Thank you. George Carlin, thank you so much. Well, there's another guy I like to quote, and his name was Joe Hensby. I met him when I was 17. My God. Down at a place called Spartacus Books. It used to be down on East Hastings. And we met at a rally because the people in Chile had just had a military coup done on them. This was in September 11th, 1973. About 30,000 people died after the CIA organized a coup against a government they didn't like, the Allende government. Well, we began to meet all these Chilean refugees, and they began to tell us how they were changing their society on the ground. They were taking over, like you heard in the song today, they were just taking over their community. They were running it according to the interests of all the people, opening up factories that have been closed down, you know, taking care of their own community, just themselves. And those examples of direct self-governance, no system, no ruler of any kind ever likes. And Joe and I were sitting there one night, Joe Hensby and I were sitting in a place called the Lotus Pub. And he was quite a guy. He was a longshoreman. He never got past the fourth grade. But he was the most educated, freest spirit I had ever met. And he said to me once, you know, I asked him, he was 62, I was 17. And I said, Joe, how have you gotten through in life having gone through so much garbage? I mean, he'd been blacklisted, beaten up all the time, you know, leading strikes that were lost. He'd lost both of his wives. He had no friends except me and a few others. And I said, well, how do you stand it over the years? And he said, well, you just can't let them wear you down. You got to decide if you want in or you want out of their system, and everything follows. And I couldn't understand what he meant by that. But it came clear over the years. You see, he couldn't explain it to me. I had to learn that for myself. If you want into the system, you're always looking for a way to rationalize and justify all the problems. If you want out, you're looking for that liberation, not only for yourself, but for others. Another thing he says is you can pretend the tiger isn't there in the living room, but if you do, it'll finally eat you up. And he was going on about people who had great theories of how to change society, but it wasn't based on anything real, the real experience. So I really keeping that in mind right now when we're talking about how do you actually bring about this change. And in fact, we've got to be very self-critical. Start by looking in the mirror, because that's the means by which we observe the world. And we've been taught, we've been raised in a very egotistical society. And in that society, increasingly we become a very idealistically based group of people. And what I mean by that is that I think it's a sign of things are so alienating nowadays. Our conditions are so estranged from what we had hoped for, especially if you lived through the 60s and 70s and had the hopes from that era, that we feel alienated. When you're an alienated individual, it can lead to psychosis, but what it does lead to is rampant disassociation. So you can't connect with the reality around you. You have to create a fanciful world. And so, you know, you go on the internet and it's quite impressive the degree to which people invent different scenarios, not based on any hard evidence, but on their own assertion. If I assert it and I believe it strongly enough, it must be true. You know, hearsay from somebody becomes fact. People don't even know anymore how to translate the reality they're experiencing into their own truths, because they're cut off from that reality. And that's a condition of being in a state of trauma. And we are all in a state of trauma. I mean, I think I don't need that to explain that to anybody. Because I think about a half century ago when I was growing up and entering the world and politics, and I don't mean this blithely, but it's a fact that even the dullest member of my generation was a lot better educated and politically astute concerning the world and its history than the most educated young person today. Because they've had their mind homogenized into an imaginative internet. And by imaginative, I say, by that I mean anything that appears on the internet can appear to be true. But it isn't. It's just words on a screen. The truth is found out there in the real world. So this is something that, you know, when you said, what is your worst nightmare of an Orwellian future? It's exactly what we're living through right now. People, mentally regimented slaves, glued to their portable telescreens and thinking the thoughts given to them by Big Brother. Now, that dumbed down cyber world is something that we're all immersed in. And we can't pretend to be able to understand the world around us if we're looking at it through the lens of our technology. We have to detach from that technology. Now, that leads to that whole discussion of what it means to be realistic rather than idealistic. Recovering a personal and political sovereignty in that system is not possible unless we've reestablished what it means to be a philosophical and political realist. And let me just give you a little bit of background and what we mean by that. There were two roots of this in Greek philosophy. Plato was an idealist. Aristotle was a realist. Plato said that there's a pre-existing ideal reality that's innate in us, rather than something we experience in the world. Whereas Aristotle said, there's nothing innate in us. Knowledge is derived from our experience in the world. Plato said, there's nothing real except what our thoughts create. Aristotle said, no, reality exists independently of our thoughts. Well, those two ways of looking at the world really evolved into two very different directions. Plato, the idealistic view, that became the religious model. You know, you've got to have faith. I remember when we were picketing the church in Vancouver, the bishop came out, and to one of the reporters, he said, faith does not require great intelligence, which I thought was a perfect description of this. If God gave us a brain, why do we have to suspend our thinking in order to have faith? That never has made any sense to me. But in the idealistic system, that's exactly right. You cannot think or analyze for yourself. You have to accept on faith what somebody else tells you to think, or you're damned, or you've got a problem. But a realist, on the other hand, says it's entirely in the hands of we the people to understand the world for ourselves. It's the ultimate democratic and radical way of looking at reality. He says every one of you can understand the world. That was the thinking of the American Revolution. They said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. That is, you don't need an expert or a pope or a king to tell you what to think or believe. You know inherently what the right thing to do and be is. It's that realistic understanding in the innate self-governance within our own minds, not just our ability in the world to govern ourselves, but govern our own minds. If you don't govern your own mind, all of this is just talk. So that really leads to the modern time, because in order to, it really, you can't have common sense without that realistic understanding. And I've had a lot of experience of this in our republic assemblies, because, you know, the first item on the agenda often is, well, what are we going to do? What laws are we going to pass? And alongside that discussion, people will bring up all sorts of incredible stuff they've just heard about, read about on the internet usually, or gossip from somebody else, about the real forces in the world, the real powers that are behind all this. And everyone's got their own theory about that, but that's all it is. And the first thing I say to people is, where's the proof? I mean, where is your evidence of that? And they don't have any evidence. It's like in the smear campaign against me, I say, well, where's the evidence? And they don't have it. It's just kind of a bad idea people have about me. But that understanding of what evidence actually is, it's something that resonates in the real world. It isn't just your idea about it. It's something that can be tested and proved in the real world. In a way, I think people would rather not deal with that because it's ugly. The real world now is very ugly. And to go out and try to enforce our laws, that's a risky proposition. So it's better to deal in the kind of fanciful, idealistic la-la land where anything can be real. But that never gets us anywhere. And in fact, the proof of that is every one of those assemblies that was involved in that level of abstract discussion rather than asking ourselves, what did we experience today in the world? What does it teach us? What do we need to do now? The ones that were idealistic in their approach, they're not here anymore. It's the realistic approach that allows us to survive. And those are the ones who kind of have survived these ups and downs of our movement, are the ones who say, well, you know, let's look at what is. And we have to reacquire that skill, because it's something that's atrophied, I believe, in the modern time. Here's another thing I want to mention. People in our freedom movement speak a lot about sovereignty and governing themselves, but their claims fall short of their actual behavior because of, we're all in a condition of collective enslavement. And when you're in a situation of massive trauma, it's a behavioral trait you've probably heard of. It's called the Stockholm Syndrome, which means loving the hand that beats you. The deep personal alienation caused in people cause us to be two-souled. Part of us hates the system and wants to fight against us. The other part of it loves us. We love the system and we're dependent on it, even self-consciously, subconsciously. Now, those minds of identifying with and wanting the status quo and yet fighting against it, those two minds tend to avoid each other normally. It's kind of like living as a schizophrenic. You keep those two realities separate. But that delusional peace between the two minds is shattered whenever the individuals are asked to choose where their ultimate loyalty lies. For example, are you going to be part of the Republic or the old system? Are you going to follow our laws or the COVID laws? Now, people don't like it when you ask them to do that, because you're asking them to choose which mind you actually are. And I've experienced that dissociative phenomena too many times to recall. That self-destructive tendency in people arises once that imbalance between those two minds becomes extreme. Most of our assemblies have been destroyed, not by outside people coming in and disrupted. It's destroyed and sabotaged by the people themselves, who grew suddenly terrified of what they were doing because they couldn't bear that inner strain of choosing between the old not mind, the old identity that wants to be part of the status quo, and the new one that's willing to jump off a cliff and risk and fly in a new endeavor. So that stress always results in the same thing. They project it externally by attacking me or somebody in the Republic, saying, you've got a problem, look at what you're asking us to do, and they turn on us and try to destroy the whole thing. I've seen this happen continually. In other words, nobody really changes unless they have to and there's no alternative. But then they always change to get back to where they were before. And that's something that you got to understand when you're talking about change. Yeah, you can say to people, well, join the Republic and then you can have security. No, that isn't really the appeal we have to be making. If you just appeal to people's self-interest, as soon as that self-interest is threatened, they're going to leave, which is what happens. You know, they're there. Well, let's see if we can join this assembly. That way I don't have to take the shot. But as soon as you ask something for me, then I leave. That tends to happen. It's because they're still the prisoner of those two minds, two-souled individuals. You can't live in a society without being dissociated. That's the reality. I noticed that as a minister people were preaching one thing Sunday, and then they were going out and living exactly the opposite during the week. But they had to do that to have those two identities, you know, stay in harmony. When somebody asks them to choose and to live a certain way, that's when the resentment builds in, and that's when you get attacked and people split. So maybe that isn't resolvable. Maybe it's only a few who can really make that break and choose and go down a different path. But the point is, this show and everything we do is really aimed at those people to say, you can't be diluted by that massive, that herd around you that's still caught in those two minds. You have to separate from them, come out from them and be separate. But you don't do that by itself, that second step. First step is you've got to come out in your own mind. You've got to come out from the division in your own mind between the part that identifies with the old and is afraid of the new. You've got to unify and not become dissociated in your own mind anymore. So that's the reason I went into that in a little bit, is because it's essential to start with how we look at the world, how we are ourselves, if any of this is to have any meaning. Because, you know, you can hear a lot of facts about the nature of the corporatocracy and that. We have an experience of it every day, but the truth is we turn away from that experience. We don't want to look at the ugly truth of what's going on. We'd rather live in our idealistic fantasy world, or our view of ourselves that basically I'm okay. I'm not collaborating. I'm an awake person. I hear that from people all the time. I'm awake. Well, I say to them, okay, maybe you're awake, but you're still lying in bed with the beast. You're lying there awake, but you're still in bed with the beast. And you have to be until you've created something different. So that's the whole kind of philosophy and spirit behind what we're doing with the Republic, based on a realistic sense of who we are. And I hope I didn't batter that into the ground over and over, but sometimes, you know, you have to repeat something several times for the mind to take it in. I think they say 6 to 7 times before the deeper memory latches onto something. And that's something we have to continually emphasize all the time in this work. That it's not so much facts as learning how to think in a different way, learning to think critically. And then you don't need an expert. You never need an expert. The truth is within you and from your own experience. Your own experience is the best teacher. And that's what we say to people all the time in this work. So that's been a very cursory kind of overview of the nature of the corporatocracy, how it operates. There's more in it. And if you're going to get the book, I would really recommend that you go to the section where we talk about the nature. It's in the latter part of the book, part 3. I go into not only the nature of our minds and how we're experiencing the world, but what we need to do to understand that this is a whole historical process that's happened. You can't look at it in a short-term view. This has come out of centuries of development, and our children and grandchildren are going to be engaged in this battle when we're long gone. So we have to understand the nature of the beast we're fighting. But that nature changes all the time, so we have to be critically thinking people. You know, like Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, the factor that determines the success of a battle is the clarity and the will of the commander. And those of us who we are developing in the Republic Alliance movement, and those of you who may be listening today, I hope you're listening, you are that leadership element. As much as you may want to deny it, you are the leadership. You need to be clear, and you need to have strong wills, and you've got to be able to fight to the death on this battle. That's what changes things. Not over days or weeks or months, years. Years of that kind of clarity and will and commitment. So, that's part of the overview. I have to apologize if it's been a bit all over the place, because the book I'm reading from it's one copy I had, and somebody went at it with markers. Somebody I lent it to, and it's so marked up. There are some parts I missed, but I was trying to piece it together on the run, but I hope some of it was cogent enough for you to understand. But look at that part 3 section. It talks about the nature of people in a corporatocracy, how it's a slave population, and it's called The Epidemiology of Domination. Please read that, page 109. It's, I think, instructive. That's coming out of years of experience, but it's my experience. You're going to have a different experience. And within the movement as well, I wanted to emphasize that we do these Saturday calls for the Republic Alliance. It's to clarify our whole perspective on this. not really even to give practical support, because there isn't a hell of a lot you can do from thousands of miles away from each other. You can share experiences, which we do every week, but you've got to apply it to your own situation and really know how to apply the knowledge in order to bring in people and train your leadership. We're not there to reach 80 to 90% of people. We don't really care about the people out there who aren't going to be convinced. We're aimed at the 5 to 8% who can be reached, who can become organized into cell groups from the cell groups assemblies, and then action cells and all the other things we need to do in order to reclaim the society, take it back. We don't fight the system, we pull out. We take away our energy. First of all, our mental energy. That's where it begins. And that's why the emphasis today on what I was talking about our two-minded nature and living in a schizophrenic, corporate, murderous society like ours, it drives everybody wingy unless you stay clear. And so on that note, I wanted to also issue a thank you for the people who have been sending in ideas. It's funny how you have to reinvent the whole story, or restate the truth all the time, because the memory of what we've done has been continually wiped out, continually. Now they're even claiming in Canada that the mass graves of children never even existed at the res schools, when they admitted 5 years ago they did. So, you know, they have to continue to swab the memory. We have to restate all the time the truth of what we've learned, the nature of this genocidal system, murderbydecree.com and republicofkanata.org. That's where you'll find us. And also, don't forget, do not get taken in by what you see on the internet. As a matter of fact, as much as possible, friends, turn off the bloody thing. Meet one-to-one. If you're by yourself, find one other person to speak to. Link up with our Republic Alliance at Republic National Council at protonmail.com. And the three-headed beast, church, state, big money. They fused. That's the nature of the corporatocracy. That's why our main enemy right now, China and the Vatican. We're going to have more. Remember to write to us to get copies if you're out in Vancouver, to go out to the University of BC campus. Teach the students that they've got to break away from this murderous system. There's Native women buried right on the campus by the Musqueam Indian Reservation. We're going to be taking more action on that in the weeks ahead. We're going to have teams in there raising a stink. If you want to be part of that, Republic National Council at protonmail.com. And finally, folks, we're going to end on a great song. Farewell to the crown. Goodbye, Charlie. Your days are numbered. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Back next week. I thank you.